Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Jacob Geller is a video essayist who covers video games, history, politics, empathy, and more. He boasts over 1.2 million subscribers on the platform, and later this year he'll release his first book. How a Video Game Lives, the annotated essays of Jacob Geller, examines 10 of Geller's most iconic essays, accompanied by brand new commentary written by the author himself. The book will be co-produced by Lost & Cult. The crowdfunding campaign originally sought to raise £60,000. At the time of recording, over a month before the conclusion of the campaign, the book has raised £600,000. We spoke to Jacob about the book, his career so far, and what he thinks about games media in 2024. So Jacob, as we sit here, you set a goal on the Lost & Cult website for £60,000 as we sit here at 2:30 on Tuesday the 26th of March. It is over £500,000 funded. How are you feeling right now?
Totally blown away. I mean, it's really scary doing something that's not kind of not the format that people have gotten used to you in. You know, it's like I had a pretty good idea that people liked watching me on YouTube. But this is a really different ask. And so for everyone to kind of respond so immediately and hugely is it's really exciting for me. And also, like, I don't work with that many people in my kind of normal job. Like, I work with James at Hot Cider on Twitter, who like creates my thumbnails. And sometimes I have external editors, but like, really, it's largely a solo effort. And so for this, having like so many people, you know, like the designers of the book included and the writers and the artists and being like, hey, we can pay you more now. Like, it's all very exciting.
So not that you need to pitch anyone on the book anymore, clearly, because it's so well funded. But tell us the log line about what the book is for people that know you from YouTube, but are asking, what is it going to do with the written word?
Yeah, so the, you know, the subtitle of the book, which I think does a pretty good job of describing it, is The Annotated Essays of Jacob Geller. So the book is going to be structured around essays that are already available on YouTube. You know, they are the scripts for Fear of Cold and Who's Afraid of Modern Art and kind of my other big essays that people have really connected to. But I'm taking this opportunity to basically fill the margins with notes. I've always really appreciated in other cases where artists kind of return to their own work and give insight on like, here's why I made this. This was my thought process doing it. You know, it's been 5 years. How have my thinking changed since I originally made this? For me, those kind of works were really helpful in kind of understanding the artistic process. And so that is what I'm doing on the book. I'm kind of going back and just writing as much as possible about the creation and behind the scenes and everything of these essays. But then there's also the kind of the wholly original element of the book, which is that we're getting 10 authors who are not me to come in and kind of write afterwards for each essay. And I'm giving them very loose guidelines. And so I'm really excited to see how different people kind of take this assignment, because they're all writers that I like tremendously respect, and I really want to just kind of let them loose and be like, okay, the subject is vaguely Call of Duty's politics. What do you want to do with that?
That is an interesting premise, especially as you say that the content is largely stuff that has already been published. So when going back to fill in the margins, as you say, how much of that of those ideas, those concepts, those kind of ruminations already existed in the old scripts, or how much was it you reflecting on that work and going back into that headspace when you first wrote it?
It's a really interesting experience to revisit old scripts, because generally, you know, it's like the way I write is there's just like, there always end up being about 10 pages of notes below the finished script that are just like the bullet points that I was like, okay, I'm reading this book, and so I'm just kind of like writing things down that sound interesting, and some of those make it into the book and some of them don't. And so a lot of me revisiting these essays is kind of rediscovering the things that I found interesting when I originally wrote them, because like I, you know, as with everyone, it's like I kind of finish these things and I then like silo them off in my brain. And I'm like, all right, that's all my writing about Pinocchio. I don't need to think about Pinocchio anymore. And so then returning to them is this really interesting kind of like time machine experience of remembering how I was feeling when I wrote those things. And, you know, I think it's been a fascinating experience to contrast those original ideas that maybe just didn't work within the structure of the essay with the experience of kind of seeing how the essay has existed, you know, 3 years in the wild, and knowing all of the feedback that I've seen people give on it. And like, you know, if I wrote this in 2020, if I wrote this in 2024, well, I obviously would have included, you know, like this example in here. Yeah. And so like doing both of those things simultaneously has been really fun.
The book is being co-produced with Lost and Cult. How did you get involved with them, and what was the creative process like? Was it you going to them with the idea, or did they influence it in any way?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been friends with the people who kind of make up Lost and Cult for about as long or longer than they've existed. You know, Ewan Wilson, who's one of the top people there, I've known for a long time. Are you familiar with Gareth Damian Martin's magazine Heterotopias?
Hey, I've heard of the name, but for those not familiar, set it up a little bit.
Yeah, so Heterotopias was this this magazine that's still kind of in production, but it's slowed as Gareth has made Citizen Sleeper and is now making Citizen Sleeper 2. But this really brilliant kind of self-published game zine on architecture. And it had, you know, like a lot of early writing about like Naissance, a game that I've talked about a lot, or Playdead's Inside, or a number of those things. And Ewan was involved there, I think. I'm pretty sure he was. And so I just followed all of those people's careers. And then seeing Lost and Colt's first big project, which was like that Sable book, go up. They've made a Sable art book that I think is just gorgeous. And I had talked to him multiple times kind of about like writing in different respects. I've contributed to their kind of like periodical called Lock On. I've like written shorter pieces for that. And I really love how kind of weird they're willing to get with their books. That's one of the main attraction for me, is they always seem to be pushing the idea of like, what can we do within the format of kind of an artistic book? Can we make the pages themselves interesting? Can we like focus on the layout as much as the writing inside it? And, you know, like since these were originally videos, they are inherently losing a little imagery when brought to text. And so Lost and Colt really seemed like the kind of people who could bring that sparkle back by like making the book itself kind of a beautiful object.
Mm. And just on that, I wanted to pick up on that, because my favorite video of yours is your Returnal one, because Returnal is one of my favorite games ever.
Uh-huh.
And that video is very cinematic, especially when you're kind of comparing it to other works of literature. Was there a worry in the selection process of this video relies too much on the imagery and this one is perhaps more foundational in its arguments, so I'll go with this rather than this one?
Maybe. I mean, I will say the Returnal essay is in the book because it's one of my favorites as well. And we're also hiring for that one. There's like a comic book artist, Zoe Thorogood, who's like doing the illustration for that. And so when picking them, a lot was like, oh my gosh, I can like commission an artist to do Returnal art. How cool is that? But, you know, fundamentally, my writing process is like I write the whole essay before I start editing video to it. And so although I absolutely do use video to illustrate points that like aren't, you know, it's like it helps that there's video when I'm describing a gameplay mechanic or something. Like, I am not a super visual writer. I do really just think of myself as like a wordsmith first, if that's not too self-congratulatory. And so I, you know, there are a couple. I think doing one on like, you know, I have some essays that really focus on music, and I think that would be kind of challenging. But like most of them that I wanted to do, I looked at how they, you know, could be laid out on a page and decided, like, you know what, these work, you know, we're not losing out on too much.
And just now that you see the scale of the funding, how does that change the scope for the book? Because presumably when you were laying it out and thinking, okay, this is the figure we kind of have to hit, now that it has far exceeded that, how does that change your thoughts on what you scoped for, what you could potentially change?
It's funny. I was having exactly this conversation with you and the other day. Because we have all seen, being in the gaming world, we've seen like Kickstarters that have gone way past their goal. And then they're like, okay, we're going to add 12 DLCs into it. Like, we're going to give you so much more. And I am really kind of the mind of like, you know what? The thing that we pitched is what people want. We're going to give that to them. I just want to make sure that like every artist involved in the book gets paid more because we've been so successful doing it. And like, you know, yeah, we might use like a slightly nicer paper stock or, you know, like maybe one of my dreams is like eventually having the book not just available kind of as an internet order, but like, hey, maybe you could walk by your local bookstore and there's a copy of it in there. And like, this funding doesn't directly correlate to that, but the being able to point and say, like, look how successful this was, is a really good tool in itself for kind of making that pitch of being like, this is not, even though this is a niche product, there is enough appeal for it that like it doesn't need to purely be sold online. And so my kind of thoughts about scope are more related to like, how many ways can we get the book out there versus what is the content of the book itself going to be? Because I've always been pretty sure what I wanted to do, and now I'm just thrilled that like we can do exactly that and we don't really have to cut corners with it.
And I wanted to ask your opinion on, there seems to be in the last 5 to 10 years kind of an explosion in grown-up writing about games, for lack of a better term. So the explosion of video essays on YouTube, which has led into a lot of these style of books, and you have your things like Lock On, you have Blood Echoes, the Bloodborne anthology. What do you think kind of your era video essayists have influenced on the way games are talked about and perhaps traditional media?
This is something that I think about a lot, because like it's true that the explosion of video essays is wild. And when I started making things, which was in 2018, 2019, I kind of felt like, all right, well, I've kind of missed the boat on this. Obviously, video essays are huge, so I'll just throw my hat in the ring because, like, I think that's fun. And now there are, like, you know, three times as many people doing it as as when I started. But I think that that has... I don't think that they're necessarily related to each other, but the rise of video essays has correlated with kind of a, you know, the downfall of journalism being very thoughtful about these same games. And I don't say that to kind of be like journalism sucks now, but more so that they're not being funded. You know, that like some of my earliest inspirations were, I mean, my earliest were like reading Game Informer as a kid and in a magazine that was delivered directly to my house, but kind of like the early Waypoint work that that Austin Walker and you know Rob Zachney and Patrick Klepek were doing, or like Harper J at Kotaku was like a huge influence on me. And all of those people are either kind of doing self-funded things or have completely moved out of writing because that sort of writing isn't sustainable anymore. It's not being funded. And so, you know, when I think about video essays and people like me, I think, you know, wow, it's so cool that anyone with a basic knowledge of video editing and kind of voiceover can make something like this and potentially get seen by hundreds of thousands or millions of people. I also think the video essays effectively have no editorial standards. They have no, there is no code of ethics that people do. A lot of games writers came in through non-traditional ways, but virtually no video essayists have gone to journalism school or kind of think about like what the role of talking about these things might be. And so it's really tricky. And I think I do think as much as we've gained in the video essay sphere, we have lost through kind of more professional writers who have kind of thought about the role of writing in their work more. I think this is a tangent kind of away from what you've asked, but like, you know, I think that a lot of video essayists start work, I certainly did, because I appreciated what other people were doing with the video essay format. And I think that's actually not, it's not a great way to kind of have a, to develop your skills as a writer. You know, I think part of what you need to do when you're a writer is read a bunch of different styles from different people in different formats, you know, read books, read newspapers, whatever. And because I see all of those other formats shutting down, I kind of worry that it's just people like me now. And like, I'm no one, you know, I've played games long enough that I know what I like and how to describe them. But like, I worry if it is only people like me kind of driving the conversation about these things, because like what YouTube likes as a topic and as an approach is often very different than what makes actual good or constructive writing.
Yeah, I've often wondered why trad media can't thread the same kind of needle, where there are a lot of video essayists that are earning comfortable livings being supported by fans. And you would think that when similar work exists on traditional games media websites, you would think that that kind of membership style of funding would work, but outside of a few big examples like early Giant Bomb, things like this, it kind of hasn't translated. So what do you think is the difference in psychology? Is it just because people like to support you, Jacob Geller, the person, rather than support Eurogamer, the entity?
I think that's a big part of it. I think that when people give money, it is often because of the kind of parasocial connection they feel to one person. And like, you know, this wasn't an intentional thing when I chose to just call my channel Jacob Geller, but like, I think it's really benefited me that when people sign up for my Patreon, or they, you know, I tell them that going to Nebula supports me directly, that they're like, yes, Jacob, that's the guy that I want to help. And even if Eurogamer is, you know, even if that money is functionally only going to a handful of people, I think it's still abstracted enough that people feel like they are giving their money to an institution, to some kind of company, rather than a person. And like, ultimately, I think the people who want to give money are way more invested in one person's success rather than kind of the wider success of an outlet. You know, I think that's probably why the most successful versions of writing like that have been like Substack or newsletters, where you feel like you are just getting it straight from one person and you're supporting them by giving them money, rather than you know, it's like if I give money to Giant Bomb or whatever, I don't really know where that's going. You know, it's like me working with MinMax, other outlets, like I know it just goes to the people who work there. But like it is, it's obscured enough that I think people are a little hesitant to do it.
What do you think traditional games media's place is in talking about and kind of disseminating information about games? Do you think it should be purely robotical? It should be BBC News? Or do you think it should be a mix of that and opinions kind of leading the conversation?
I mean, I think that the kind of the use of games media as simply informing people about what games are coming out is something that's been almost entirely superseded by the ability of publishers to just talk to their audiences now. You know, it's like when I was reading Game Informer, E3 was not live streamed. And so to find out what was happening at E3, I would have to like read a games magazine. And no one has to do that anymore. You know, we don't need a write-up to tell us what the release date is for a game, or even kind of like, hey, there's a new trailer, because we're all just getting that specifically from the publisher. So I feel like now there is even more of a need for kind of like having perspective, and specifically kind of having a long-term perspective, because that's, you know, that's something that games media really struggles with, because it's so unstable and because it doesn't pay anything, is like people don't stay in it very long. And when you do have someone who's been there for a long time, their ability to like think back 25 years is really important. And kind of like, that's, you know, that's one of the things that I loved about Game Informer, was like everyone who had been working there for 20 years. And so like they had this great institutional knowledge. You know, when I do research on older games, the kind of writing that I'm hoping to find is that very, you know, opinionated, perspective based, like contextualizing the game within its moment. Because if I want to read about how Devil May Cry 3 was perceived, it's not really helpful for me to just hear like, this came out on this date and it is a third person, you know, action game. I want to hear people talking about like, how does it compare to the other games that's out? How is this a movement forward for the genre or whatever? And like, that's what the kind of robotic BBC-esque delivery can't give you. And like, you know, just from a historical perspective, that's what I find most helpful.
And do you ever see games media in its current form being a comfortable home for some of those veterans? Because even if you think about the people that have been in it the longest, with extremely few exceptions, people like Jeff Gerstmann, he's spun off multiple times and is now just on his own. There are very few elder statesmen, elder stateswomen in the industry. Is games media ever going to be that home? Or is this... I often think games media is almost like kind of a proving ground to earn an audience, and then you go off and do your own thing. What do you think about that?
That is what it feels like, which is a bummer for me. You know, like, I would hope that at some point outlets would recognize the value of keeping someone around, like the, you know, the value of having a long tenure in this. And that's kind of what I was hoping things like, you know, Launcher from the Washington Post would be, of kind of more traditional media bringing people in. And it's like, okay, we recognize that games are kind of a newer thing to talk about, but we're an old newspaper and we're going to run ourselves like an old newspaper. And that hasn't panned out. So I think that we're going to hit a breaking point with the number of individually funded people. I think that there is going to be kind of a, I'm surprised it hasn't happened already, but like a Patreon crush, where there are just like too many individual outlets that are being supported exclusively by individual contributors. And I don't know what we're going to do then, but I feel like at some point, it is going to loop back around to like, what if we did have a news outlet and it just wasn't, you know, helmed by a venture capital idiot? You know, like I think that the kind of death of most of these sites isn't necessarily that they are individually not successful, but just that they are being held to standards that, like, media as a whole is almost impossible to reach. You know, they want it to act like a business that's increasing their profits forever.
It's pretty inarguable that the biggest disruptor of that was YouTube. How do you feel about YouTube as a platform for talking about games? You mentioned Nebula previously, which is a video sharing service that a lot of prominent creators like your Lindsay Ellis's of the world are part of. So how do you feel about the behemoth that is YouTube in 2024?
You know, I think that the thing that YouTube can do that is really, it has its dark side, but it is really magical, is, like, you know, put a piece of writing in front of millions of people in a way that almost nothing else can. You know, that, like, a blog cannot be algorithmed in the same way that YouTube can. And even, you know, things like viral tweets or whatever, we all know it's like people don't actually read the article that it's attached. There's nothing else that I can think of that can get people to, like, sit down and watch an hour of amateur writing. You know, like, I think that is a pretty incredible thing. And, like, when I think about Nebula, which is this thing that I'm a part of and really believe in, it's like, it's not intended as a replacement for YouTube, because Nebula will never be able to do that thing of, like, just choose someone and, like, show them to people. And, like, that is what happened to me, and that's the reason that I'm able to do any of this, is because I made a video on Looking for a Secret in Shadow of the Colossus, and YouTube just decided that, like, that's a video that millions of people would like to see. And so, like, I do, you know, there are infinite downsides to that type of recommendation algorithm. We've seen how it kind of leads people in dark spirals and radicalizes them and all that. But, like, I don't think it should be understated that, you know, like, a lot of people's exposure to someone talking about art in a thoughtful and near academic way, which is what I try to do, comes from their faith that, like, YouTube is going to provide something interesting for them. And so, like, I do view that as an upside. And I don't know, as long as it's good until it's bad, you know, like, it's great for me and other thoughtful creators who I really like, and it's bad for kind of outrage clicks. And it's often hard for me to kind of, like, square the positives that I feel about that system with the negatives that come from the exact same system.
As you mentioned, it kind of democratizes the value of opinion. On traditional media, you look at the outlet and you think, well, previously you would think, okay, if this is coming from the New York Times, it lends a level of prestige, but YouTube, anyone can put up anything they want, and thus the only real measure of what is correct or what is authoritative is views. Do you think there is a way around that, or is it just a case of people develop who they trust, and for better, for good or ill, that's kind of what they go with?
Something that even traditional outlets have been doing, or at least, you know, enthusiasts reading traditional outlets have been like, how do you deal with the fact that reviews of art are inherently subjective, and different people might have different tastes than you? And the answer has always been, find writers that you like. Even if you are reading the New York Times, they have multiple film critics. One of them is probably closer to your taste than the other. And so, like, you know, it's a reliable system to be like, hey, I've liked most of the movies that person has recommended. I'm going to follow this person now. And I think YouTube makes that a lot easier, because you are basically always following individuals, and so you're getting that perspective. I think, you know, the thing missing is that even the perspectives at the New York Times they're supposed to have fact checkers. You know, that there are certainly examples to the contrary, but, like, traditional media's, like, editorial standards do generally exist outlet wide, and so it in the past has been difficult for people to go on and write completely unsubstantiated nonsense without it being caught by some sort of editing process. Obviously, you can find instances to the contrary, but like that's generally how it worked. I think what is challenging about YouTube is just like you don't know what that editorial process is. That, you know, the person you're listening to might have the same thing. They might be really knowledgeable about one thing and really not knowledgeable about the other. And like you don't have a way of kind of knowing what that is unless you can see their behind the scenes. And so I think their traditional markers of good writing still apply. If you can see that person is citing sources, you know, if they are like referring back to other things, because like good writing is not just having original ideas a million times in a row. It is, in fact, reading other people, expanding on their ideas, being informed by them. And so like I think that there are things that you can watch out for to know if the person that you're following has kind of done that work. But it is way harder, and it's one of the kind of unsaid benefits of like being at an outlet is like that work was supposedly done in advance of readers reading it. And with YouTube, there is a single step between the producer and the audience. And so that, you know, that level of editorial oversight just gets completely skipped.
Just on that, how often do you worry that you've got something wrong? Be that your interpretation of something, maybe a take, or even as small as fact-checking. Do you have processes in place? Do you show cuts of the videos to your audience beforehand? How does that all go down?
I worry about it constantly. You know, it depends on the thing. If I am simply talking about how I experienced an artwork, I'm not too worried, because it's like, sure, people can disagree, but it's not going to be a factual disagreement. They'll just say, you know, oh, you missed the point of this story. And I'll respond, no, I think you missed the point of this story. And like, that's it. But there are, I mean, like in a video that I released yesterday, I got Francisco Goya's death date wrong by 1 year, you know? And it's like, it doesn't change the meaning necessarily of anything said in the essay, but it is frustrating. And I wish that I could go back and like that, you know, I have like a giant book on Goya that I was reading, and I just wrote down the year that he died wrong from that book. And so it's like, I run into the same things with pronunciation, where like, I talk about a lot of, you know, a lot of artists and a lot of ideas that are not originally English, and I want to pronounce them right. And sometimes I'm able to go and watch a recording of that and accurately recreate it. Sometimes I watch a recording of it and I just can't, because I don't have kind of the linguistical skill. And then often, I don't even know that I don't know how to pronounce something until you do it, you know, in the same way that everyone has kind of like, I never realized I had only been reading that word and hadn't said it out loud and been corrected yet. And so like, it is, you know, I kind of try to have my fact checking happen first, almost by drawing from sources that I know are kind of peer reviewed or officially published or done all this stuff. But like, I wish that I had those layers of kind of reviews and edits to send it through. And like, I don't really, unless you count Patreon seeing it a day early and being able to call out like, oh, hey, you didn't unmute this audio track, and so half the video is silent.
I suppose that as you mentioned, that is the double-edged sword of YouTube. You can be so responsive to things, but that can also lead to having to make a response to that response, because things have evolved in real time. Whereas in my world, if a story changes, we can just put a little box in and say, update, this isn't true, this is true, kind of thing.
It's one of the reasons that I generally avoid talking about things that are too recent, you know, because it's like, as well as just not knowing where a story is going to land, like, I really rely on reading other things about it. Like, I want to be able to work from the critical reception to something and kind of decide how I share my thoughts with that critical reception or how mine differ. But it's really kind of scary to not even know what that is. I mean, recently, this is a completely different example, but it's like I beat Final Fantasy VII Rebirth before that game released, and those like couple days of like knowing what happened at the end and having no one even like started the game and then be like, what am I gonna say about this when it comes out? Like, I, you know, I had no idea what the critical reception to that game was going to be, and it's a very kind of scary feeling to just be like floating with your thoughts and no other context.
Yeah, the moments after you've sent your score to Metacritic and you start hearing from friends what they've given it, you're like, oh god, this is going to be fun because this is going to live forever. Before we get into some questions from your viewers, I have a good friend, Hamish Black. He runs the channel Writing on Games, does a lot of video essays, and I can always tell when he's playing something when it's about to turn into a video idea. How do you play games for fun, and how do you turn off that bit of your brain that's like, this is work, this is content, for that terrible word?
First of all, love Hamish's work. He actually, here is a round of revisions. Before I published my Last Great Secret in Shadow of the Colossus video, he looked at that script and like gave notes on it and was like, I think you could make the story point clearer. And that was like my first huge breakout script, so I will always be
really
appreciative to Hamish for doing that.
Well, this entire podcast owes a lot to Hamish Black, because I recorded my first gaming podcast in my mum's kitchen with Hamish when he had like 10,000 subs or something like that. But I just loved his stuff, so look at him now. But yeah, how do you play games for fun? How do you turn off that voice that says, I'm thinking of something here?
It is really challenging. You know, it's like a lot of I've The Helldivers has stopped my Fortnite playing, but it's like a lot of my like gaming nights with the boys were like just playing Fortnite, because that's a game that I like know I do not have any critical thoughts on, you know? And so it's just kind of like, hey, this is purely kind of dumb entertainment for me, and I don't need to engage my like, oh, what's the take on this? I think, you know, a lot of that now for me comes from replaying games, you know, and specifically even games that I've already talked about. Like Metal Gear Rising Revengeance has been the subject of a video. I know I'm not going to make another video on it. So like going back and playing that game is purely kind of a fun exercise. But it's really hard to get away from the feeling that like, if I am, I don't think I have a Balatro video essay in me. And so now my like 20th hour that I'm spending on Balatro, it does feel a little bit like I'm wasting time, even though it's just something that I enjoy and we're due for enjoyment. Like it is hard to get away from that feeling. And I haven't mastered it. Like I don't, you know, it's I don't quite know how to turn off and simply enjoy something.
I know that feeling well. FC24, formerly FIFA, is my game that I was just like, I don't think about. I review those games every year, but after that, I don't think about it in a critical way at all. I just play it. And similarly, while I was reviewing Dragon's Dogma 2, I was playing and Rise of the Ronin, I was playing a ridiculous amount of Balatro, and it became quite good time to ruminate on what I thought about the game, because it was just, you're just doing the same thing over and over
again.
You're
just like, okay, full house, straight, two pair, good job.
And then you start to think, oh, that means this is this, and this connects to this, and this is a good way to frame the argument. Everyone that is in kind of our realm of work has their game that they just play mindlessly when they're not playing work games. I know people
and then,
like,
you know,
crying
and then
or whatever.
You read Renata Price recently wrote a piece on Balatro that is like a really interesting critical take on like that game and its themes, and so it's like, oh, there is no true turn off game, you know? That like every game actually has interesting analytical stuff you can do with it.
It certainly does. Before I let you go, let's get some questions from your viewers. Dreamcast Guy asks, Jacob's videos are so winding and impressive. Does he ever get deadlocked during the creative process? The final product is so tidy that it all seems seamless, which usually means it is as hard as hell to make.
I think that I don't get deadlocked during the writing process itself very much, because I do a lot of, you know, it's like I kind of pull in all of my stuff before I start writing. Like, I want to know the different media touch points for each thing. And so, you know, it's like the hardest thing for me is kind of figuring out, like, it's very easy to just kind of give an analysis of one thing. The challenge is kind of making sure that if I'm talking about, like, you know, a movie and a game and a painting, like, how am I relating the three? How am I making them all kind of, like, thematically consistent within the work of the video? And there is a lot of kind of, like, interrogating my own ideas to make sure, like, does this work as one thing? And you can see, again, in my most recent video, there is this theme of kind of, like, seeing work from artists that they didn't necessarily intend us to see. You know, something like Prince dies and he leaves an entire vault full of music, and we don't know if he wanted us to listen to that music or not. Kind of, what is the ethical thing to do with that collection? And, like, at the end of the video, I can't really answer that question, and I, like, say as much, you know, but it is, like, sometimes there is this experience of kind of, like, I find this really interesting, I'm going to dive into it, and then on the other side, like, there isn't just one thing that I can say about it, and so you have to find a way to make that ambiguity interesting in itself, and maybe try to relate, you know, not having an answer to the rest of the video. So a lot of it is kind of, like, little writing pieces of sleight of hand to, like, make everything feel like it works together.
Aiden asks, any book recommendations? I read Greenwood because of his 2023 favorites video and I loved it. I now need more Jacob novel choices to read.
Let's see. I haven't read any, like, novels. I recently read Naomi Klein's Doppelganger, which is a book where Naomi Klein, a kind of longtime political writer and reporter, writes about her experiences constantly being confused with Naomi Wolf, a longtime political writer reporter who kind of went bananas with, like, COVID conspiracies and now is kind of, like, a fixture of the Alex Jones InfoWars world. And that is a really brilliant book that's kind of talking about the ways that doppelgangers are used in different fiction and in different kind of, like, political climates in the world. Otherwise, I always recommend Patricia Lockwood is my favorite writer, and she has a memoir called Priest Daddy and a semi-fictional work called No One Is Talking About This, and I recommend both of those very highly.
Very nice. This isn't a question, this is just a comment. Miss Pavlichenko says, just to tell them that as a French person, I hear nothing wrong with the way he says Rayman. So
this is a long-running bit on my podcast Something Rotten, where I say now Raymond Raving Rabbids. I say Raymond Raving Rabbids, and my co-host Blake Hester refuses to cease bringing up that I pronounce this in a very strange way.
So it's the old Mario Mario thing. Like, it's just pronunciations. We read these things as kids, and then it gets, like, stuck into our head.
I say the title Devil May Cry, and I put the emphasis on, like, May, and I don't know why that's happened, but, like, that's how it exists in my brain now.
That sounds like that's a person called May rather than they may cry. It's May Cry. Bruno Bega asks, does Jacob have a white whale topic, something he would love to make an essay on or something he would talk about in the future? Let's not go for something you've got planned. Let's go for a world in which how many people like it or watch it does not matter remotely. What would you talk about?
I mean, that is kind of the strategy I take with my videos. Like, I don't generally, you know, often I've been like, really, people are interested in Pinocchio? I kind of thought this one was going to fall flat. For a long time, That White Whale was actually the game, the beginner's guide, just because it is my favorite game and I was like scared to talk about it. And so then finally, in this video that I released yesterday, I've talked about that one a lot, but like it took months to put that video together. I fit that in and I was really excited to kind of get it in there. I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of kind of like strange childhood fears that I have worked some into essays, but like I do feel like a lot of my essays are kind of figuring out ways to work through, like, why was I so scared of that as a kid? And like there are definitely some of those that I haven't touched on and like might get brought up in a future video, and I feel like that's my White Whale is just further psychoanalysis of myself through these topics.
Speaking of the beginner's guide, that's the question from me. What is a game that you've watched a video essay on then tried out for yourself? Because I when H Bomber Guy put out those Pathologic videos, I tried that game, and as he warned, I bounced off almost instantly because it was just too much for me. Has there been an instance of that happening to you, or do you just stick through it because you want to see why this person's so...
Oh, no, I mean, I bounced off Pathologic specifically. I had the same experience. I love... There are whole genres of games that I love hearing about that I... It's like, I've made some efforts in the past to get into fighting games, and like I think they are so cool structurally, you know, like what a fighting game is doing and the way that people talk about them is really great. And I watched, you know, I've watched video essays on them. I watched Competitive Smash for a long time. Recently, Patrick Gill at Polygon made a video about like why Tekken is so interesting. That I really loved. But like, there was just such a high ask to kind of begin interacting with the systems in the way that they're talking about that I've never quite made it there.
I Am Become Box asks, while I share Jacob's concerns for predatory monetization practices, I've fallen a couple of times into the delayed variable reward system that some ostensibly predatory games provide. Has Jacob ever fallen into these trappings via gacha games or otherwise?
I don't think so. I have a lot of anxiety about just spending money ever. And so like I am much more the like, I am going to drive the fun of this game into the ground before I spend $2 on it. You know, but I'm trying to think of the skin purchases in Fortnite where I've been like, well, I absolutely need to have that. Oh, well, I think recently, was it Alan Wake? There was an Alan Wake. Oh, and then there was Snake and Raiden that they put in the store. And I immediately bought Raiden and then realized I was like, that was like $17. That was like a lot of money for the privilege of running around. It's like a, you know, a character skinned as Raiden. So, you know, I've certainly spent money in the past, but nothing that I've felt myself like going down a slippery slope for.
Just on that, I almost thought that the recent drama around Dragon's Dogma 2 microtransactions was a bit of a throwback. It was a bit kind of horse armorish because it was really passionate arguments about purchases that were a couple of pounds, whereas you turn on Fortnite, you turn on Apex, you turn on Warzone, and you are spending the price of incredible games on these digital skins. Why do you think that? Do you think it's just a slow creep? Do you think the war has been lost?
I don't know. I mean, the Dragon's Dogma thing is bizarre for a number of reasons. You know, as many people have pointed out, like exactly the same type of microtransactions happened in Resident Evil 4 and Devil May Cry 5 and like, you know, all the Capcom Monster Hunter games. I think part of it is unfortunately that Dragon's Dogma is such an interesting, frictiony game that like removes quality of life features from other games to its benefit, that then players feel like the game is missing something and that it's telling them they have to buy it, when in reality it's not true. And it's like, if you buy many of those things, you are sucking the fun out of the game itself, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, it's not clear to me exactly why, or maybe it's clear, but it's disappointing that this has become, you know, the lightning rod for those sorts of conversations. But yeah, I do feel like we have just almost written off certain genres as like lost causes. You know, the fact that many multiplayer games are free to play now means that we're okay with their super predatory monetary practices. Mobile games as a whole, there was a very short period where mobile games were like really interesting, risk-taking works of game design. And like that has just completely slipped away as they have all devolved into kind of slot machines. And so it's sad, but it also feels like, you know, if you got mad at every new multiplayer game that had $1,000 worth of microtransactions, you could never talk about anything else. So I do understand why people make the choices that they do.
Okay, the final fan question and the most important one. From Happy, how many tacos do you think you could eat in an hour? Like cheap soft shell tacos from Taco Bell, the only other thing you have to help is water.
Gosh, I am not like a competitive, I'm not like a man versus food style eater, so I think the number would be like disappointingly low. I feel like I could probably have, let's see, if you had like 15, maybe that would be like a taco every 3 minutes. It's like, you know, because at the beginning you could certainly eat a taco a minute, you know, but it's like you're going to start slowing down pretty fast. And even 15 seems pretty high. But I think under the right circumstances, I could do it.
Under like competition rules, if you've had a chance to prepare. Yeah. I often think about that. I watch... there's a guy on YouTube who's called like Beard Meets Food or something like that. And he goes around the world eating these ridiculous things. And I sit there with my partner and I'm like, there's a certain mindset that I am very rarely in that I feel like I could do this. But if you were just throwing them down constantly, like I just don't understand it. I also feel like you'd have to be doing something at the same time. If I had a good YouTube video on, I could just go. I could just not even think about it.
Yeah, it's like if you don't have to consciously take in how many tacos you're eating, you're just, you look down, it's like, oh, I guess I just ate a dozen.
Yeah. Well, that's I think that's a good premise for a future video, I'm just saying. Or perhaps when the book
mukbang
is...
Jacob Geller video. Yeah,
exactly.
We'll get it started.
Or perhaps when the book is all said and done, maybe a stretch goal that we get the mukbang video at a certain amount of cash. Before we go, Jacob, I appreciate your time greatly. Where can we find you online?
So the easiest place is my YouTube channel, which is just Jacob Geller. There you can find links to my book, How a Game Lives, which is also available on Lost and Colt's website. You can find me specifically on, I'm just Jacob Geller on Twitter. Maybe check out the Something Rotten podcast, which is something that I do with my friend and co-host Blake Hester, where we play so-called rotten games. We are just finishing a season on Disco Elysium, which is a very beautiful game, a staggeringly beautiful game that also has a lot of rotten themes, and we are digging into both sides of that.
Excellent. What are you up to for the rest of the day then? What does your day look like? Are you just refreshing the counter on Lost and Cult and smiling?
I wish. I think it's time for me to start working on the next video, which I think is going to be some kind of tying together a bunch of weird indie games. And so it is kind of a fun day because I'm just going to like try and find some games that no one has talked about yet and play through them.
Excellent. Well, Jacob, thank you very much for your time. And thank you to all of you out there for listening to this episode of VGC, the Video Game Podcast. We will be back with our normal weekly news show. But until then, from Jacob and I, it is goodbye. And we'll see you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset.
and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.